I'm somebody who wrote anonymously for the first, I don't know, 40 years of my life. Like I didn't start, like I have a TikTok account now. Like now you have to have your face. Your face is now part of the product. But this is very new for me. This is not what I'm used to. I came up on the internet when it was just all text. You could claim to be anybody.
Yeah, that's when I came up too. Man, it feels like we're already getting going. Should we start?
Yes, let's start the show.
I used to separately do an intro, so I'm trying to just do it live. We'll give an intro a shot here if you don't mind. Hello, friends. Welcome to Mostly Harmless. I'm your host, Damn It Damien. Buddies, super excited this week for this week's chat because this week we're hanging out and we're chatting with one of my all-time favorite authors, Mr. Jason Pargin.
Hello.
Hey, buddy. Jason's here today to talk about his newest book. If this book exists, you're in the wrong universe. It's the fourth and potentially maybe last book in the John Dies at End series of books. He's also the author of the wonderful Zoe Ash series of books, including Futuristic Violence and Fancy Suits and Zoe Punches the Future in the Dick. Also, Jason, I mean, man, you've done a whole lot of stuff. You're also the executive editor of Cracked Magazine for a long time. Jason, welcome to the show. How the hell are you doing on this Wednesday morning?
I'm doing all right. Is it a spoiler to say that I'm already under contract to write a fifth book in the John
Yes.
Dies at the End series? Because I guess that would imply that the one that's coming out right now does not end with every single person dying. Oh, the fifth one could take place in the past. You don't know.
Or a different universe. Like
Yeah,
you
you don't
explore
know.
so many other alternate universes in this universe, if this book exists. Man, this is a long title. Can I just call it John 4?
Yeah, you can call it whatever you want. There is a rule in publishing that if you want to be really successful, you need short titles. And like Stephen King used to be really good at this, like It or the Tommyknockers, Cujo, like one word, one or two words. So I, to set myself apart, have very long, stupid titles for my book. You mentioned the one I published before. This was called Zoe Punches the Future in the Dick. They are long, partial sentences that probably harm sales in any number of ways, because when people are searching the title, they probably don't remember the exact phrasing, that kind of thing. But mostly, I do it just to amuse
Well,
myself.
and what I like is when people come over to my house and they see this book is full of spiders on the shelf, or when they see this on the shelf, it's gonna pique their interest in a way that Tommyknockers might not interest them.
And I don't want to make myself sound like a master of promotion, because no creative person wants to be known as that. But if my theory has always been, if nothing else, if you see it on the shelf and you get a brief chuckle out of it, if I've made somebody happier for the next 5 seconds until they've completely forgotten about it, that's something all its own. Just especially if they get to that section of the bookstore and maybe they've got all my books there, and they see the increasingly stupid titles as the series goes on, they will maybe grin slightly. And maybe their day will be 1% happier than it was before, even if they don't buy the book. I've at least reached someone, or it might just annoy them. That's part of having my personality. You just never know.
Well, I devoured the new book. It comes out October 18th. I've already been ranting and raving about it to my friends. I think they're annoyed of me ranting and raving about it. All four books, I loved them all. I listened to them and I found them. An ex-girlfriend gave me John Dies at the End years and years and years ago. She had found it on Pajiva, the website, and introduced me to that website and your book, the only two good things that came out of that relationship. I've been following you and your work ever since. I was really impressed that you were the editor of Cracked Magazine, or I'm sorry, Cracked.com, different than Cracked Magazine. And then you also found time to just publish all this material. I've always identified very heavily with the voices in the books, John and David. And I'm starting to, this week I've really been listening to you, and you yourself are not what I expected. I expected somebody a little bit more anarchic and chaotic. But I'm curious, where does those voices for John and David come from? Are they deep in you somewhere, or is it something you're grasping or channeling?
So the voice of, and this is something that a lot of authors don't talk about, and it's something a lot of readers don't think to talk about, which is like the tone or the voice of the narrator. I don't think a lot of people realize that when writing a book, a lot of times the first thing that comes to you isn't a character or a plot. It's a voice. It's like a tone. I remember this, Stephen King saying that The Green Mile, the thing that occurred to him, the one, it wasn't the plot about this guy on death row who can do magic. It was the voice of this narrator, of this kind of cynical but good-hearted, this guy who works on death row, the prison guard, played it by Tom Hanks. And that tone, that voice, his worldview, that's where it started. So here, the voice of David in the books, the fictional character who is, it's written, it's first person, and then in the beginning, it was put out there like he was writing it like autobiographically. That voice is something that when I first started writing on the internet in the late 90s, so 25 years ago, Jesus. Back then, it was routine not just to write under some sort of a username. Like back then, I didn't know anybody that was writing under their own name. Like that wasn't, it wasn't just an anonymity thing, but I think part of like hacker culture, which was where, you know, the internet, the early internet was all these young computer nerds. And so the thing with like having some sort of a username like Demonfire187, something like that, was just the norm. Like you would read a blog post and you just expected it to be, you know, written by someone where the byline would be in a newspaper. The byline there would be like pork sandwich or something. It's like a gamer tag. So people would not only write under a fake name, but they would also often create like a fake persona, usually trying to be more badass than they were. There were a lot of men writing as women and vice versa for whatever reason. And the internet was a place where you could just assume kind of a different voice. I think people found it very liberating because that's where you could make the jokes you couldn't make around your parents. You could say the things or express the opinions. You know, if you were an atheist, as the young internet was overwhelmingly atheist, and you were in like this hardcore Christian household, the internet was where you could go and make fun of the church and the things you would never dare say in front of mom and dad and grandma and all that. So for me, when I started blogging, the first thing I did was starting to develop this voice because I was writing as this fictional person. And he was a character that I had created, I think, in high school for a story. But it was this guy lived in a small town who was the opposite of me in just about every way. He was this drunk, angry, extremely bitter, cynical, unemployed person who he was a white guy using the alias David Wong to keep his enemies from finding him because that surname is so common on Earth that he thought, well, this will make it hard for them to track me down, which made no sense. He was in a small town that was like entirely white. And the point was that I developed that voice because it was very funny to write as him. It just his worldview, it's someone who is smart in a way that doesn't help him at all. He struggles. He goes from job to job. He gets fired from jobs. He has trouble with authority. He has trouble fitting into any kind of an organization. That he's a guy who can walk into a business or a home or anything and immediately tell you what's wrong with it within seconds. He can point out 20 things that's stupid about what you're doing, but can't actually do anything himself. So it is a when you're experiencing these stories from inside his head, or as in my early blogging days, when you're experiencing the world through his head, you know, when he's writing about, because the early website was everything. It was movie reviews. It was just anything I thought to write, but translated through this guy's brain and then through John, an equally fictional character created by my friend Mac, that it just, these two like clashing personalities. That's where the humor came from. Because it's not just observations I'm making, it's observations seen through the lens of this fictional person. And that fictional person became famous on the internet early on, not me. And I loved that. I loved that I was totally separate from it, that like nobody knew I was writing it. Because again, at the time, I was working a day job and I was making jokes and points and expressing opinions. I didn't want anybody confronting me about in real life. I put it out there, and if it can find people with a similar mindset, that's great. But then when I started writing fiction a few years later, it was just published on the same site. So it was naturally told first person from the same point of view. And so I had a unique advantage in that I was writing my first book with a very fully formed narrator's voice that I'd actually been developing for years prior to that.
I love, you're so good at this. You manage to weave like the basic plot and narrative of these books into that explanation. You've been doing this a whole long, long time. Does, in writing countless, countless articles and essays for crack.com when you were working there, how does all that writing just prepare you for sitting down and hammering out these books? Do you, because a lot of what is written on the internet is disposable. How does that make things less precious for the books you're actually writing?
I'm a big, big believer that writing in general, in any format, it requires practice. So if nothing else, there's a part of writing that's very, it's like the opposite of the sexy part. It's not the imagination and daydreaming and visualizing. It's the more mechanical process of quickly bringing to mind the adjective you want to use, knowing like instinctively how to phrase a sentence and you know how to paste things. A lot of that stuff just has to come from practice. And this is where a lot of young writers get frustrated, because they have in their mind a great idea and they may have a unique point of view and all that, but the actual bricklaying process of building the words, they get frustrated by, because a lot of the minutiae of paragraph length, and is this character talking for too long before someone else is interjected, or if it feels tedious to describe, you know, what someone is wearing or room or anything like that. I think that's where, if you have another writing job on the side, which I was extremely fortunate, like being able to have Cracked as the day job, and I had a lot of freedom to write almost whatever I wanted there, but it was nonfiction. It was essays, it was columns, it was opinion pieces. But it really doesn't matter, because the basics, the brick and mortar process of writing, of being able to craft language, and in my case, a lot of stuff is humor. So being able to craft punchlines, getting a feel for how frequently you need a joke or that kind of thing, getting an instinctive sense of what the reader will be patient with or what's going to make them drift away. Of, you know, are you adhering, you know, is it clear that you're driving toward a point, are you losing them? Are you spending too much time? Like, and that's a case where working with editors, that kind of thing, and just seeing traffic on columns and articles and all of that, it helps a lot. This is why that's the one piece of advice every writer gives. Like, if you want to write, the big thing is to just write and keep writing. Even if what you're writing isn't going to make you a penny, you need the practice writing to make the boring part easier for you. And then once the boring part is easier for you, once the actual mechanical process of having, you know, the right words and sentence and phrasing and language come to mind, then you can focus more on the sexy part and the imagination, because the actual process of translating it into words for the reader is more frictionless. That when you're new, because the actual act of getting the words down is so difficult, people kind of walk away from it. It's like, well, this is so much harder than I thought, or so boring or whatever. But it's boring because you're burning so much brain power on doing the word by word. It's same as somebody trying to learn to play guitar and you're trying to play your favorite song and you get frustrated because it sounds like garbage. It's like, well, that's because your fingers don't know where to go yet. Like, you're still having to stop and think about where your fingers go and stop and think about, whereas once that part is more natural, once you've got hundreds of hours of practice, then you can make something beautiful come out of the instrument. But you have to do that other part first. So I never want to make it sound like the time I spent at Cracked or all the hundreds of articles I either wrote or edited, I never want to make it sound like that was drudgery or whatever. Like, this is a job I had to do on the side just to make money. That was all practice. It all served as practice for me. And it all made me a better writer. At least I think it did.
I've been watching your career for some time, and recently I've made the decision that I am working to be more of a professional writer myself. My voice is a little bit more, you know, David Sedaris meets David in your books, I guess, David Sedaris meets Arthur Dent meets, you know, David Wong. I don't know, something like that. But yeah, it took me, where I was going with this is that I recently I moved to small town California. I've mostly done music journalism, but during the pandemic, I figured out that like I just fucking love writing. I don't care. So I went to the local newspaper and went, "Hey, do you guys need any music writers?" And now I'm writing for music, for the newspaper. And a lot of that came out of watching you specifically, hammering away at all these cracked articles over the years while also simultaneously putting out the books. I could see that. Oh, I can develop my voice and my craft over here and actually make a little bit of money for it. And so first off, I just want to thank you for showing that way, showing that there is other paths to doing this.
And I try to emphasize that part of my story because I think there's lots of people, like I follow a lot of writers and I follow a lot of reviewers. And so there's a lot of advice out there about how to get published or how to craft, like a cover letter for an editor, that kind of thing. And I think for the most part, that's probably not the toughest hill to climb in terms of becoming, a full-time writer or whatever your goal is. I personally think that the hard part is you have to put in a bunch of probably unpaid writing or very low paid writing in somewhere, one way or the other. I personally don't know any way around it. So like in my story, I mentioned I started blogging in the late 90s. I got my first like paying job as a writer in 2007. So I had a solid almost exactly one decade of writing for basically nothing. Like the ad revenue from my blog would cover my hosting expenses, and that was about it. And this was, I was for a while updating daily, either a short post from me, or I was editing a short post from somebody else, and then a long column every couple of weeks. And I did that for a decade. Like John Dies at the End was first the novel that would make my career, that would buy this house that I'm in. It was first published online for free. That went on for 5 years, from like 2001 to like 2005 or so, before it would make it into print, before I would sell the film rights. That all started with a solid half a decade of giving that story away for free on the internet before a book deal came along. And, the market is different now, but I don't think it's any easier now. Like these days, a lot of people get their start on, the fan fiction sites, things like that. Or one of the, like, there's more outlets now for self-publishing, or they may just do a book and get it self-published on, like, for e-readers or on Kindle. That marketplace didn't exist when I got started. Like, there was no such thing as like self-publishing an ebook. There wasn't, the Kindle didn't exist back then. So there's different pathways now, but I still believe from what I've observed that it still involves several thousand hours of either low-paid or unpaid writing. Not because I want it to be that way. I would love to live in a world where, like, the US government gave out grants for people to get started as a writer, or where if you know a rich friend who will just pay you to write your book. Although, I guess if you meet a rich stranger and they offer you a whole bunch of money to write a book, there's a real good chance that they actually, you're being lured into some sort of a, you're going to be hunted for sport on an island or something like that. But the point is I'm not saying this is the way it should be. I'm not saying I'm happy about it. And I'm definitely not saying, please do not think I'm saying this, that because I had to write all those years for unpaid, well, then by God, you have to pay your dues too. I would love it if that wasn't true for anybody. I would love it if everybody could, make a living writing if that's what they want to do. I'm just saying what I've observed from the way the media environment is now and the way book deals are getting made now. As far as I can tell, it's as true now as it was 20 years ago that the only way from point A to point B is to do a whole bunch of writing for probably very, very little money and probably not exactly the type of writing you want to be doing. And then from there, you get noticed, that there's many pathways, but all of those pathways, as far as I can tell, they all have to cross this river or a moat around the castle. And the moat is made of a bunch of unpaid or very low paid writing. And it may be as simple as like these days, having a very popular social media, platform or on Twitter or on YouTube or whatever. It's the same thing. As little as YouTube pays and Twitter pays zero, you're still doing a bunch of writing for free. You're doing it for exposure in the hopes that this builds up enough of a platform and a fan base that when you get a book together, you've got somebody who will buy it. So I try to push that because I never want to make it sound like, well, if you're talented and you've got a really powerful story to tell, you'll get noticed and you'll make a lot of money from it, like I did. It was a long, arduous struggle that involved a lot of writing for exposure. It just did. And even then, it took a couple of incredibly lucky breaks for me to get here.
One thing I really do like is looking through your stuff, particularly your YouTube. There's a sense of mentorship about you, and it's really cool that you do that for others and you help others. Did you have people that helped you out along the way figure out these lessons and things, or?
I think people who usually are like this and they have this kind of attitude, usually they're people who did not have that growing up. And not that's not the fault of anybody. It's just I wasn't from, as I've tried to emphasize before, I was from a very small town in rural Illinois. I was, in other words, I wasn't growing up around writers or in New York or around editors or around the industry. I don't know if the average person realizes that when you watch TV or you listen to music, if you go look up any of the actors you're seeing on there, how often their parents' names have their own Wikipedia pages when you click on them. And it doesn't mean that they're all famous or that they all inherited their success, but it does mean that, like Billie Eilish, one parent I think is a musician, the other parent is an actor. They were able to get them in the room with the right people. They knew the business. They knew, the whole process of getting representation and all that stuff. So just being in the orbit around certain people, that's whether they acted as mentors or not, being able to observe grown-ups doing the job you want to do means everything. Like even if it wasn't like an official apprenticeship, just being around it kind of meant the world. So for me, through, no fault of anyone's, I was born in a place where I didn't know any writers, or of all the things I thought I maybe wanted to do when I was a kid, that there were not examples of that around. It was a town that was surrounded by cornfields. And there was just not a lot of industry there. There was, the main good jobs were, there was a couple of oil refineries. It's an oil rich area. And there was nothing that kind of appealed to me. So if you're someone who dreams of someday, again, they did not have the internet when I was a kid. That's how old I am. But dreams of being on the radio or writing for magazines or being, I went to college for journalism because at the time that was like the closest thing I could think of. Because the idea of like, well, I want to grow up and write weird horror novels or horror sci-fi novels or whatever, there was no path forward for that. So now that I'm in a place where people ask me constantly, how did you get here? It's, I didn't have to have some revelation like, oh, I should go mentor these people. I'm taking to YouTube or to TikTok or whatever to answer the questions people ask me over and over and over again. Because the moment I got the movie deal in 2007, I got hired at Cracked right around the same time. Everybody is asking, well, how did you do that? Because it's like you now have the thing that everyone around you wants, which is a very strange position to be in, because up until age, when I left to go work at Cracked at age 32, I was working at an insurance company. I was doing data entry on insurance claims, which again, a very sweet job. It was air conditioned. Not like I was out, having to work on a roof or something in 100 degree heat. I'm not trying to make it sound like I was taken from an orphanage. Or rescued from a prison camp. It was a pretty good job for where I lived. But I wasn't like doing creative work there. I wasn't writing ad campaigns. There was nothing about it. Like I got it through a temp agency and then just got elevated to full time at some point and worked there because it had health insurance, because it was for an insurance company. So insurance companies tend to have decent health insurance for their employees. So to go from that, making, whatever it was, like $9 an hour, I don't remember what the pay rate was, doing data entry in a cubicle in a place where I was not considered to be very good at it, and no one there thought, wow, this guy's destined for better things. That I never heard that. In fact, I was not, in line to get one of the supervisor jobs or anything like that. To go from that to everybody asking me, how did you do it? How did you do it? And it's like, I'm not sure you want to do it the way I did it. This kind of feels like luck. It kind of feels like I banged my head against a brick wall for 10 straight years and then suddenly just found myself popping out the other side at like a cocktail party. And everybody's like, congratulations, you did it. It's like, really? That's the process? I just fail for a decade straight and then you just pop out the other side. So when I tell the story, I try to never phrase it as like, okay, here's what you do. First, you find it. First, somebody invents the internet while you're in college and invents the World Wide Web. So you'll be one of the very first bloggers because literally no one's, that word doesn't exist yet. And then you do this and you do this. It's like, no, I'm trying to emphasize that the path I took involved a lot of labor that I did not expect to pay off. I wrote this story online not because I thought, oh, I will parlay this into a book deal. I didn't think that was possible. There was no such thing as people writing on the internet and then getting book deals out of it in 1999 or 1998. That had never happened. And it would be years before it would happen. It would be a long time before that would become like the standard path to publishing. I did it because I liked it and because I wanted to tell people a story and I wanted to make people happy. And I did that for years. And I almost now, if I wanted to be like an influencer type, I would say, well, the universe was trying to test me to see, am I passionate about writing or do I just want to profit for it? And I had to first prove to the world that I just wanted to tell stories to people. And then I was rewarded with money. In reality, we live in a capitalist system where we don't invest in people unless we're 100% sure they'll be able to pay you back. So it's more cynical than that, but I think there's an element of truth to it in that the reason this book is unique is because when I wrote it, I wasn't worried about anyone reading it. It was free. It's for free. What are you going to do? Get a refund if you don't like it? It's free. You can read as much as you want, or you can quit whenever you want. And that attitude of, look, I'm going to be as weird as I can here, take it or leave it. And this book, this novel is going to be my writing school. I'm going to learn how, I'd never written a book before, and I'm going to learn how to write a book right in front of you. And you're going to read it or you're not. I don't care. And then it's only as good as it is if you do think it's good because I didn't care. It's the book of somebody who did not care. And I think a lot of, if there's ever a band where you felt their first album was the best, it's probably a lot of the same thing. Because when you get to the second, third, and fourth album, it's like, okay, what do the fans want from us? Is it going to be too weird if we go this different direction? And your best mindset is just like, no, I'm going to tell the story I want to tell, and then what happens, happens. So I try to emphasize that. If you can put yourself in that mindset of, I will write this whether it becomes a career or not because I just want to write it. I just want to tell stories to people. That's where you'll probably do your best work. And because the reality is that most people don't become financially successful writing books, it's a tiny, tiny fraction of the people that try it.
Yeah, I have this new romanticized idea that I just want to be the guy that works at the local bar, and the regulars saddle up to the bar and they go, "Hey, Damien, what you working on?" And I talk to them about it, and maybe they read it or don't. And I'm trying to do things more personally, and trying to put more of myself into it, just as you're talking about it. And it is, it's a lot more rewarding in a lot of ways. One thing though that I that my mother is one in particular, who's like, maybe you should not be as weird and put as much personal stuff out there. So, but I disagree, and I like listening to you talk about how like you just put all the weird stuff out there. I mean, it still took a while to work, but do you ever worry about putting too much of yourself
I
out there?
did at one time. I mean, that's why I wanted to write anonymously. I wanted to give myself the freedom to expose whatever part of my personality that I wouldn't. But now that's not possible. There are people who follow me on TikTok now, and it's my big face and my voice on there every single day. That's very recent. That's not the person I was. I did not grow up with that. I did not grow up with cameras on my face. And the entire reason was that it was very liberating to write something that is that profane and that weird, that all over the map or whatever. But I cannot emphasize enough. You will never come up with a unique book idea or a movie idea or whatever you want to write. You'll never be the, if you want to write a poem, you'll never be the first person to write a poem about the woods or about death or about growing old or whatever. The only thing that will be unique is you. Your voice, the lens through which this story is being told, your personality, the things you've noticed about the world, That's what's going to make you unique, whether you know it or not. So I think this is where it's frustrating, because there's this thing where people will be like, oh, does this, yeah, the world really needs another podcast. It's like, yes, it does, because you don't have one. Like, what's going to make the, it's like, what, would we need another podcast where it's two guys talking to each other about pop culture? Like, yeah, if you two don't have one yet, yes, because it will be the only podcast in the history of the universe to be hosted by you two guys. Now, if you, in the course of making your podcast or your book or your poem or your song, set out to sound like somebody else, because it's like, oh, this is what sells, I'm going to do Joe Rogan, I'm going to do whatever, then yeah, you will create something generic, because you're just trying to mimic what has worked. What will make it unique, what will make it worthwhile to the world, even if your audience is 13 people, is the fact that it's you and your voice, because only one person has your voice. The part where the practice comes in is in translating your voice to the reader. That's where the mechanics of knowing how to write, of doing the hard part, the tedious part, it makes it more, it lets you effectively deliver your thoughts and your feelings to the reader without the inability to phrase things getting in the way. Same thing with playing the instrument. Like, there's music inside you that is only unique to you, and there's emotions you want to convey through the music, but before you can convey those emotions, you have to learn to play the instrument first, and that's very tedious and boring. But once you do that, once you've mastered that part, then you can, whatever, you know, is the mystical part, whatever is in your heart or your soul, whatever, then you can bring it to people once you've done enough practice. So that's the thing, but it has to have an element of you in it, no matter what you're making. That's got to have it, because otherwise that's the only chance you have at creating something unique, because you are unique. There's only one of you, no matter who you are. Nobody else out there has your exact experiences and memories and personality and worldview.
I sit and I think about the stuff, this kind of stuff, all the time. I don't really have a community of people that I can sit and talk about this stuff with. And so thank you for coming on and providing me some sort of community. How much thought and do you, like, I sit up late at night and I think about storytelling. I think about breaking things down. I think about voices and characters and whatnot, and like how to make all these mechanisms work and how all the pieces put together. I have a feeling that maybe you also think about this stuff way too much. Does your brain ever stop running? How often are you sitting there thinking about the mechanics of all this stuff?
I generally can't get through a movie or a game or a book without observing how they pulled something off. Like the last movie I watched, I think, was the Top Gun sequel. It's not that it stops me from enjoying things, but watching it and then kind of seeing how they tried to tie in, like, okay, this movie is clearly for the dads, and so they've built in this fear of their job being automated away. For those of you who have not seen the Top Gun sequel, the underlying premise is that they're wanting to move away from pilots and move toward drones, unmanned aircraft. And so the whole thing is like, you know, old Maverick and then all of his old fighter friends. He's like, he's got to come back for one more mission that could only be done by a person. And so it's one of the oldest, it's a story that's as old as the Industrial Revolution. And I'm trying to remember the name of the poem with the guy with the hammers going against the steam engine.
Oh, is it John Henry?
Yeah. And you know, and it kills himself trying to beat, you know, the machine. And it's a story that resonates with anybody who's gotten older and feels like, you know, they're the thing that made them special, their skills are not wanted by the world anymore because there's some computer that can do it or some machine that can do it. So when I'm watching Top Gun Maverick, like, the stunts are great. The flight sequences are spectacular and exciting. It's beautifully shot in a way that really makes you feel like the characters are at risk, mainly because it was shot using real planes with the actual actors in the actual plane, so they could have died while shooting the movie. It all works great, but I can't watch it without stopping to kind of smile at, oh, the emotional through line here is something that this screenwriter, in a very calculated way, knew would appeal to the middle-aged dads, because it's all about, hey, here's, you know, you want to give my job to some machine, well, let me show you what I can still do at my age in my 50s. You know, I still know a few tricks, and it's kind of transparent and it's fun, but it's the same thing any horror movie I watch. You know, if it's there's like this really gruesome scene where a slasher, you know, that like the most recent horror movie I watched was the Korean South Korean horror movie I Saw the Devil, and it has these spectacular makeup effects. But in the scene where there's an extreme close up of a guy shoving a knife through his victim's Achilles tendon and chopping it, and it's extreme close up, it's such a great makeup effect that I'm sitting there saying, that is a great makeup effect. Like, that's probably a prosthetic foot that's probably cost $50,000 to make that just for that shot. Like, that really looks good. It's not CGI. You know, they can. It's hard for me to not have a layer of, you know, if you're a bricklayer, you drive past a building that's got really nice bricks, you're going to notice it. It's like, hey, that guy knew what he was doing. You know, I like it. And I will say this, a good part of my training in knowing how to tell stories, things like that, is paying very close attention to the stuff that I hate. Not just making fun of it, saying this sucks, but understanding why, understanding where it went wrong. And
Yes.
if there's a skill, because there's a lot of that on the internet now, like just making fun of bad movies, like, oh, this sucks, this is stupid, this new Marvel show, like we've got an entire YouTube video longer than the series of shows. Like our actual runtime of our criticism is longer than the thing we're making fun of. And it's all just about trashing it and calling it lazy or woke or whatever their genre of video is. The one thing I can tell you, if you aspire to work in any of these industries, don't let yourself just hate something. Really look at it and try to see where it broke down. Why you didn't feel anything? Because it's like the climax of this movie I'm watching. The whole world was at stake. You know, it was threatening the end of the world if they didn't succeed. Why didn't I feel anything? And then you'll realize, oh, the end of the world was kind of an abstract thing. They didn't make it personal. You know, I kind of didn't care because I know the real world is not going to blow up. So they didn't kind of make me care about the world that they're saving. And then you look at it and say, well, what could they have done better? How could they have brought this home a little bit better? How do the movies that did engage me, you know, how were they successful in doing that? Why is it when I watch a movie like Braveheart, when it's all about the independence of Scotland, why do I care if Scotland is independent or not? Like, how does that impact my life? Answer is that you don't. The movie made you care through a lot of very subtle tricks from people that knew a whole lot about storytelling, and it's in the words and the script, it's in the editing, it's in the performances, it's in the soundtrack. It's all these things that came together to manipulate your emotions. Well, if you want to do that for other people, you need to know all of those tricks. And I call them tricks only in the sense that knowing how to cook a steak properly is a trick. Like there's nothing dishonest about it. It's the skill of knowing if I want to tell the story, I want to make the audience feel the same thing I feel. I want them to make that, you know, this thing that I find funny. How do I convey it in a way that will make them laugh just as hard as it makes me laugh? What's in perfecting the timing and all this? It can all be learned. It's some of it's natural talent. I do believe natural talent is a thing, but the vast majority of it can be learned. These are skills that you could teach them in a class, but mostly you just have to do it and do it and do it and get a little bit better each time.
Would you ever teach? I think you'd be a great one. I mean, I guess you kind of do it already, but would you ever park up in that classroom setting?
No, because I know that so much of teaching is not that part of it. It's just not a very good job. Like the fun part of explaining things to people, and you know, it's like here where I can choose, I can only teach the stuff I already find interesting. Well, teaching where, for example, half of your class doesn't want to be there or more, because even in college, right, people are taking a creative writing class as an elective. Like they're taking it to get credits, because they're required to take a certain number of electives. Like in me trying to explain what I'm just explaining, like explain it to you as someone who's eager to know this stuff versus explain it to a group of bored 19-year-olds who are just want to be anywhere else and they're just bored to tears because they don't want to know any of these things. I don't think I would have any patience for it. I'm not patient with people. I'm not patient with repeatedly explaining things to people that I feel like I'd already explained very plainly. So the format that I do it, where I'm just making a TikTok video and I've said what I want to say and now it's done and now you can talk among yourselves in the comments. But I don't, for example, I don't answer questions from people. I don't come into the comments and like clarify things. Like, nope, I've said it the way I wanted to say it. Now I'm done. I do it in a way that requires very little from me.
This is a lot of the lessons that you're teaching me and hopefully our listeners today is stuff that I've thought independently on my own, and it's great to hear other people like voice those opinions. I do want to. It does make me wonder though, because I do identify with John and David so much. I'm like, man, is there something wrong with me? Because they're interesting characters, which I'm trying to segue into. We're really here to try to get people to jump on and buy this book, while also I secretly want to learn all these lessons that I can use for in my own life and career. And I'm not sure where I'm taking the segue. I'm just kind of hoping it figures itself out before the end of the sentence here. But that's how I write now, and a lot of that is inspired by stuff that I find in your work. And it really does capture this kind of anarchic feeling that I feel inside. And it really resonates with my inner voice. How different is your inner voice? Where am I trying to go? Any of those thoughts spark anything with
Well,
you?
for example, don't let me act like I came up with all this in a vacuum. You
Right,
mentioned
right,
like
right.
Arthur Dent from the Douglas Adams, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy books, which obviously the title of this podcast is taken from. But for
Sure
the
is.
listeners who somehow didn't know that, probably at least one out there. Like I read that in high school probably, and it changed my life because you can see multiple things. One, the sheer density of where he as an author, and for example, Douglas Adams is a very slow writer. He talks about like writing five sentences in a day and then he has to go just take a nap because it's so much. But when you read his books, you can tell every sentence has a punchline. Every sentence has a funny observation. If a character walks through a door, there's something funny about the door. If he sits down at his kitchen, there's something funny about the tablecloth. Like he holds himself to an incredibly high standard, but he creates a book that you can read over and over and over and over again because your brain can't retain all of those jokes and observations. You can remember how it ended, you can remember the general arc of the plot, but the way he won't let himself write a boring sentence, because you will find yourself, if you're trying to write anything long form, you'll find yourself writing a part that you're not really interested in. It's like, I just want to get to the action scene. I just want to get the character there. And you can see, watch carefully, how Douglas Adams is like, no. There's something funny about how the characters got there. He may have spent all day, he may have spent a month sitting there thinking, what's something funny about the way they can get to this next scene, about the ride over, the taxi cab ride over, or whatever, the spaceship that took them to the restaurant. What's something, there's got to be something there, and would not let himself move on until he had that. And then the thing about the narrator, there is no question. Because for those of you who have not read the books, the whole funny thing about The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is that it is this wondrous universe of spacefaring people, but the main character and the narrator is Arthur Dent, who is this guy who lived in England, and I guess rural England, and just does not want to leave the house. He just wants to stay home and not be bothered and to kind of sip his tea. And so he intentionally picked like the worst possible person to be taken on this adventure, because he's the opposite of Luke Skywalker, of the typical archetype of in the hero's journey of the person who, they aspire to greatness, or they've got a talent they've discovered. You're Harry Potter and you've turned 11 and found out that you've got the magic inside you and you got to go out and face your destiny. And so being a humor author, it's like, he was doing the exact opposite of that. Arthur Dent just wants to go back home. And so the entire adventure, all of these amazing things are happening in front of him. And for the most part, they're just all lost on him. It's just largely, he just sees it as a series of inconveniences and
He just
annoyances.
wants a cup of tea.
Yeah. And so there is no question that, because obviously I don't have the point of view of the distinctly British. Rural British, like the attitude and like his dealings with the bureaucracy and local British government, that stuff is all foreign to me. But what I can do is say, okay, it would be very funny if the people I knew growing up, in this very small, not just a small town, but a dying town, a town that was nice in the 80s, but due to globalization, the jobs have fled. The same thing we see with America, where everything is migrating to the cities, and these rural areas are just crumbling under meth, under unemployment, all that. Take that point of view, and you've grabbed this kid and a couple of personality types from this small town of people who are very cynical about the world. And one of them in John is just adventure, adventure, adventure with no forethought, no self-preservation. Like he's so bored, he will just go do anything. He's like constantly doing stunts on his own. He's just like a brain seeking out dopamine in a place that offers, that doesn't offer it. Like there's nothing to do there. So you can see he has dealt with it by, I'm just going to invent my own fun. I'm going to make my own fireworks. I'm going to accidentally almost kill myself 3 times a year trying to do stunts in my car, versus his friend Dave, who has just shut down. Like he doesn't want to leave the house. He's clearly depressed. He doesn't know he's depressed for the most of the story. Like all he knows is that the world just seems lifeless and dead, and that nothing is very interesting to him for very long. And so he just wants to do the bare minimum work, come home, drink, zone out. And then it's like, so you got these two people, one who kind of doesn't care about his life in the sense that he will just run headlong into danger, and the other who doesn't care about his life because he just doesn't get any joy out of anything. And then the two of them are having to cooperate to take on a scenario and a force that they do not understand and that no human could ever understand. And it's almost like, the opposite of a movie where you've got like experts, like in Ghostbusters, they were academics. They actually, they had a background. They knew what they were doing. These are two guys who are not equipped to handle this at all. And then all of the flaws in their personality accidentally make them good at it. Because it's the way they approach it, and then you add in Amy into the mix, and that you have a bunch of incomplete people that together are accidentally good at tackling the problem, partially because of they have no sense of self-preservation, because they don't care, but that's the exact same thing Douglas Adams was doing. But very few people read this like, oh, you ripped off Douglas Adams. Like the influences and the inspirations are clearly there. But it becomes something your own. And so if somebody has read my books, and by this point, I've been doing it long enough, I don't doubt they have. If they say, oh, I set out wanting to write my own version of that, it's like, that's great, because your version of it's going to be different. Because like, well, yeah, I grew up in Australia, for example, and it's like, yeah, that's going to be a totally different outlook than what I had. But you're going to take that's what's unique about you, or if you grew up, in the inner city or something like that. It's like, yeah, that's a totally different place that you're coming from. So when they talk about like write what you know, it doesn't mean if you worked as a plumber, you have to write a story about a plumber. It means think in terms of your own headspace and then how that fits with the story you're telling. Because again, the challenge that Arthur Dent was facing, the challenge that John and Dave are facing, in every case, it's chosen and it's written to fit perfectly into their personality in the funniest way possible, because it's the worst possible person on paper that you would want to be facing these challenges, and of all the people on Earth to have to go on a spacefaring adventure to try to save the Earth or whatever, he's like the last person you would pick. And that's what's funny about it. But that story and that character, those were not created separately. They were created to fit together. It's all part of the same package.
It's the time that we should start wrapping up, and I don't want to stop, but it's like, how, so tell us about the Zoe. I've only had a chance to read the first one. Futuristic violence and fancy suits. That's the only one I've read. I'm saving Zoe punches the future in the dick for a rainy day. What's going on with that
To
universe?
be
What can you tell
clear,
us about that?
like for example, people in these interviews often ask me what books I've read. It is shameful. Don't get me wrong. I buy a lot of books,
Oh, me
but in
too.
terms of actually reading them in this world, with between work and with all the other things that can be distracting me, I read a shamefully few books. And so when somebody tells me, "Oh, I've only read 4 of your books," it's like, That is a spectacular time commitment. If someone came to me on the street and said, "Hey, will you read these four books I wrote?" Like, that's a form of assault in most states. So no, I don't. Most of the interviews I do will be with people who have not read the new book, and that is fine. I will. It's a. It's. I would never demand somebody read a whole book when I've seen people on Twitter that don't get to the end of the tweet I wrote. They only read the first half of it and then reply to that.
Your books in particular are not chores. They're more like treats for me. But
Well, they
anyway.
were written by somebody who was raised on the internet and has a very short attention span. They move. If I have crafted the plot right, it should feel like you've been fired out of a cannon, because I am somebody who has no patience for long, slow books. That is a shameful thing to admit for a professional novelist, but I can't help it. My formative years as a writer were in the 90s era, blogging era of the internet. And when you're
In
writing,
journalism.
when you're writing on the internet, well, it specifically is TV journalism, where you've got 30 seconds to tell the story. You know, you've got this much text, and you've got to move on to the next thing. But anyway, the Zoe books, this is a science fiction series, takes place in the very near future, maybe 20 or 30 years from now. But it's a future where the cars still don't fly. There's not like sentient robots, but social media is far, far more advanced. And the technology, the things we've focused the technology on has advanced to an absurd degree. And so it takes place in a city, a fictional city. It's like a Dubai type city in the sense that it was just planted in the middle of the desert in Utah. This giant, sprawling, new, brand new city. It's somebody built there as like a charter city. It was a place that would have its own laws. And it's basically this giant, lawless city that somebody has planted in the middle of an area of the country that right now just has like a few small, charming, small towns. And that's it in southwestern Utah. And so there is a young woman lives in her trailer park and finds out, basically to spoil part of the events of the first book, but it because of the way we promote the series, it's now known what happens. She winds up inheriting a giant amount of money that it turns out her father made by being a criminal. So she finds herself at the head of a futuristic, somewhat dystopian crime organization as this regular woman she is working as a barista prior to that, and through a convoluted series of events has to like continue running it because there's no way to shut it down, basically. So it's this absurd thing. If you want to take it as a metaphor, it's the way I think any young person feels when they find themselves as an adult and you realize, oh, these people are just as stupid as the other high school kids. It's like, I didn't realize, I assumed the adults knew what they were doing. And it's like, no, I'm an adult and every adult I know is an idiot. Well, it's similar to that, where she is kind of handed the reins of capitalism. Like, she has money and businesses and land and realizes, oh, these people are stupid too. This whole thing is dumb. So she has to go on this series of adventures where she's basically having to manage the city and manage these crime organizations and keep peace in a city where there's not really any law to oversee things, in a world in which they have a social media network that will probably exist before the next book comes out. But basically, it's everyone live streams through, because cameras are tiny now, but in the future even more so. So you can just have like a camera and a pen or in a button that just streams your life, and the collective cloud of all of these streams is a social network you can browse. In other words, you have a God's eye view of everything all the time. You can jump into any car that's driving into their dash cam. You can jump into any webcam, any camera, a live streaming cam, somebody's carrying any drone. So any event that's happening anywhere in the world, in the world of the Zoe books, you can just browse there and go see it. So if there's like a mass shooting that breaks out in a town square, it will trend instantly, and then you can go watch the mass shooting occur live from any one of the 75 cameras that happen to be in view of it at that moment from overhead, and just blinks from view to view to view. And so it's like, what does life look like when you finally reached a place where you have the panopticon, where it's real? You are always on camera all the time. So the supposed clever part of the book is looking at what does a society look like when everything is a performance all the time. Because right now in our current world, if you're saying, well, it's kind of like that already, but if you go to a restaurant and you have a conversation today, you still will have a heart-to-heart with your friends with the assumption that no one is recording you. Like, that is not, it's different than if you were doing it on a Twitch live stream. Well, imagine a future where if you are outside your own doors, you're being recorded. Everything you say, you do, you wear, every gesture is being observed. Well, what does that do to the world? So it is exploring a bunch of different ideas, but it's partly that, and it's kind of a world in which that has almost replaced the law, because now the force of what the pressure other people put on you, the pressure of their expectations, when you now have an audience wherever you go all the time, it's kind of about that. So it is, as by the titles we gave you, they are equally as silly as the John and Dave books, I like to think. But hopefully, if I've done it right, like any science fiction, it should give you something to think about. It's not just being stupid for stupid sake. But if you want to read them that way, you can. The books are always supposed to be, if I've done them correctly, and I'm not trying to say that I have, but they are generally as dumb or as smart as you want them to be. If you don't feel like pondering what a book means, there's plenty there to just, if you want to read it on the beach for a while, it should make you happy. But also, if you want to read it and then read it a second time and then talk to your friends about it, if I've done my job correctly, there's a lot of stuff there to uncover and to think about.
Nice. Jason, I think with all this, I feel pretty good. I feel like we've if we haven't at least sold some people on checking out your books, maybe some new writing ideas, or I mean, even some of the lessons that you taught today that apply to writing can apply to anything, like you talked about playing guitar or painting pictures or whatnot. So hopefully I think some people, I know I got some stuff out of today. Is there anything else we should talk about before I let you go about your day?
I don't want to keep you super long, but there is something that's worth talking about, which is sure. Shows like yours, where you're interviewing creators, I don't know if the average person realizes what an important part of the creative ecosystem that is. Because this is like me doing my tour for the book. I don't go out in the world and do like sign books for people. I've never done that. I've done it a couple of times, but doing the tour where you're going city to city, I don't do that. I'm always afraid that I'll get stabbed by a crazy fan if I do that. So I do this and I talk to people. If a friend tells you, oh, I have a podcast where I talk about books, these days, because everybody's got a podcast, it's very easy to be like, that's great. Like, congratulations, you paid $40 for a microphone. Now you have a podcast. I cannot emphasize enough, the shows that are supported by Patreon, the shows that are supported by people asking you to donate money or to do whatever, if they went away, then the ability for new independent creators to get their stuff out there and to be able to do it as a job would also go away, because this is how it does it. And you have an ecosystem where a new book or video or thing, you know, 8,000 of them are being made every second, and there's an ocean of content. So if you're a young person trying to get yourself out there, the first thing you're going to be saying is, well, how do I reach people? How do I, it's stuff like this. When you talk about supporting creators, it's not just supporting authors, you know, or whatever authors you want to support, authors, you know, of whatever genres you want to support, whatever, you know, race or gender identity you want to support, whatever. It's not just supporting those creators. It's also supporting the outlets that help bring attention to them, because what they're doing and helping to like boost voices is crucial. Don't take them for granted. The show, there are so many shows that I did the last time I had a book out that I won't be talking to this time because they're not around anymore. Yeah. Because so many people, you know, you go 2 years between books, and in that 2 years, these people have all, they've just dropped it. They've dropped their website. They've dropped their show. They've dropped their YouTube channel because they had to go get a job. They had to go. It's like, no, I can't devote the time to this. It never made them enough money. It never, you know, and there's so many people who, like, you know, I all but gave up on writing when I turned 30, because it hit me that I was like, I'm 30. I can't still have this stupid dream of writing, because it's not going anywhere. Like I've been doing it this long, because I still had that idea. If you haven't made it by 30, you're just a loser.
It's funny, I've written about all this stuff on my website, all this stuff that, well, not all this stuff. Thank you for the kind words about the stuff that we're doing, but all this stuff only at 40 being like, God, am I dumb getting back into this again? But I actually quit doing this for a few years and was during the pandemic and was actually like reading that first Zoe book. I was like, I really want to talk to Jason. How can I talk to Jason? Well, I guess I can start up my podcast again. And then it took about a year to get to the place where this book is coming out and for us to actually do this. And that's no bullshit. Like, that was one of the reasons why I restarted again, was because I wanted to talk to people like you. I make $0 on this, but I gained so much in spirit and connection. And the through line I found in all my work, because I think about that, is I'm just trying to connect with people and hopefully get other people to connect. And so thank you for the very, very, very kind words. It is nice to feel seen
Yeah.
doing all this stuff, because it does feel like just talking to the ether and no one listening. So thank you.
Yeah. And so I know that it's a standard thing people say at the end of the show. It's like, well, like and subscribe, leave us a review. If you really do enjoy listening to somebody every week, when you're looking at your entertainment budget, like $3 or $5 a month will mean way, way, way more to them than giving that same amount to like Disney to for Disney Plus. And you sit in, you added the number of hours of stuff you've listened to for free. So please do. It's not just like I come on these shows like, hey, buy my book. I'll be fine. The creators who are helping me get the word out, so a lot of these people are doing it for pennies per hour of labor. Like, you look at their Patreon, they get paid like $450 a month, and that's really
Wow.
good for a Patreon. But it's like, considering the number of hours it takes just to edit a podcast, let alone all the stuff behind the scenes and talking to people and arranging for it and the back and forth and communication, it's what it comes out to per hour of labor is nothing. So that's all. In this world as it exists right now, if you're listening to creators who are not famous ones, they're not Joe Rogan, they're not Mark Maron, there's people trying to make it with a Patreon or whatever, they all desperately, desperately need your money. Devote some of your, go without like one like Starbucks coffee a month if
Yeah.
you can, and throw it their way. It will mean the world to them.
Well, I threw out the Patreon a few myself because I was only getting like $10 a month.
It's
But
hard. It's hard to get people to pay, and I get it. I do.
Well, I'll just say, like, if anybody's out there want to PayPal me $5, I'm easy to find. I'll take it. I'll spend it all on beer, I promise. Jason, I think I th man, this has been a really great chat. Huge thanks to your publicist, Sarah. She worked real hard to make sure that we got a chance to talk. I'm working three different jobs right now, and like, this is a rare window that I had, and she really did like work hard to make sure that this happened. So those people at St. Martin Press really believe in you and your book, and I hope you know that as well, and hopefully they're taking real good care of you.
Yeah. The title, for those of you listening to this in your car, it's If This Book Exists, You're in the Wrong Universe. My name is Jason Pargin, Pargin. If you want to follow me on any of the 11 social media platforms I maintain, just go to any of them and search that name, Jason Pargin, and it will come up. I'm not going to give you all the usernames, but I'm on TikTok now, if you're not on there. If I'm on Twitter, I'm on Instagram and Facebook. I have three different Facebook pages. I have a Substack. It's all under that same name.
Jason, thanks so much. We'll talk. I hope to talk again soon.
Yeah, well, the
So
next
this
book, new
was
Zoe book
delightful.
coming out a year from now, fall 2023. Unless if
Can't
it doesn't
wait.
come out, it means something bad has happened to me. It means I've been killed or something. But if I don't go to prison or something like that, then yeah, we can talk then. Keep doing your
Can't
show
wait.
for the next year. That's your motivation to keep at it.
I think I will. I think I will. All right, buddy. It was good chatting with you, and we'll see you in a year.